Hey everyone, so recently I had an episode where I talk about how my wife and I bought and then renovated a home, and we created a budget template to track costs and hopefully limit our spending and stick to the plan as much as possible. So with that, I put out a budget template that you can go and get, and that was our most downloaded freebie from the Career Yak show thus far. So I'll put a link again in the show notes. Go check that out if you have any type of projects, or you're renovating a house, or you're doing even a smaller project and you have to see what it's going to cost and track costs throughout so that hopefully you don't overspend. Go check that out. Super helpful. Just wanted to remind everyone of that. And thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
The first time that you go there, you stand at the steps and you kind of take it in and you look around and you're like, you think to yourself, holy cow, this is the Pentagon. All this awesome stuff happens here. And, you know, I can't wait to be a part of it all.
Hey, everyone, and thanks for listening to the Career Yak podcast. I'm super excited to share today's interview. I have Jason Grauer as my guest, and he is a veteran of the U.S. Navy. He is a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and the Naval War College, and was a Navy pilot. He's toured internationally, and as you heard from the intro clip, he has served at the Pentagon. So he shares some insights and details on some pretty cool jobs that he's had in his military career. He now lives and works in southern New Hampshire as a regional operations manager, and recently made the transition from military to civilian life. Really excited to share this with you. Hope you enjoy. Jason and I actually met. I was working with a bucket and crane truck dealer. Jason was working with, as an operations manager for Dead River. And I called on him, made a cold call, and he happened to be in the office and was nice enough to give me a few minutes of his time. Jason has a long military history and has recently transitioned out of that. So really excited to have you on the show, Jason. So if you can just introduce yourself and where you work now, and then we'll kind of go back to the beginning and go from there.
Yeah. Hey, Chris. Sounds good. Absolutely. It's great to talk with you. Great to be here. And thanks for having me on. I'm really excited. It's the first podcast for me, so it's very exciting from this end. But yeah, as you mentioned, my name is Jason Grauer. I work at the Dead River Company, and I'm still in the current role that I was in when you met me a few months back. I'm a regional director of operations at Dead River Company, and we're essentially a fuel, oil, and propane company that also offers heating system service to our customers. And been around since 1909 in the industry, so we're a family-owned business, and it's great to work for a large company that's run by a small family. It gives it that real good feel, and it's awesome. It's a great place to work, so. Anyway, great place to work, great place to live, except maybe not now here in southern New Hampshire. We're having good snow and ice and sleet, freezing rainstorms. So as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm probably going to go outside and snowblow.
Sounds fun. Yeah, my driveway this morning was like a hockey rink. So they're based in Maine, correct? They are a New England company then?
Correct. Yeah, we're a New England company. Our footprint encompasses Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, and a tiny little sliver of Massachusetts.
Do you enjoy kind of the smaller scope of that? And what do you oversee? Do you oversee just New Hampshire? Or?
Yeah, the scope itself is pretty broad responsibility-wise. I oversee all of our operations through most of the state of New Hampshire, and that includes delivery, that includes service, that includes customer service.
You know, is this totally new for you, or is it kind of a bringing in of the skills from the military days? What's kind of the feel of it? I know you're pretty new into the role still.
Yeah, it's a great question. And honestly, the role is different. The industry is different, but regardless of where you go and what you do, the concept and the idea of leadership and working and managing people is the same, because people are the same no matter where you go. You're going to have your high performers, you're going to have your low performers. And the key is how you deal with it and still get the job done all at the same time.
Right, right. So jumping back, I was stalking you on LinkedIn as I stalk all my guests.
It's good. It's my only social media account.
Yeah, there you go.
Except for Twitter, @Grauer_J.
Okay, all right. It's funny, when people don't have a LinkedIn, I'm like, what do I do now? So you went to the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis and wanted to kind of, you know, one thing when I was, whether it's in high school or college, there was some of it, you know, where people show you what's out there, show you different careers. But one of the things sometimes I feel is lacking in certain arenas is telling young people, you know, a broad base of what is even out there and what industries, what opportunities, you know, do I have to go to college? Do I not? So how did you, when you were in high school, decide I want to go to the Naval Academy? And what was that process like?
Yeah, that's a good question. And honestly, the bigger picture here is, you know, what do high school guidance counselors do, you know,
and
to find a really quality one is really difficult. And I didn't have a good one, but fortunately for me, believe it or not, it's kind of crazy. I decided when I was 10 years old that I wanted to be a Navy pilot.
Really?
That I was going to get there. Yeah. And the way I was going to get there was I was going to go to the Naval Academy, and that was going to be that. So I set a goal for myself then that's what I was going to do. And everything that I did academically, everything that I did with sports in high school was kind of oriented towards that. So part of the thing here, though, is having a plan and executing the plan, but also having a plan B. And so I had a plan B as well, where I also enlisted in the Navy and a nuclear submariner. And so it worked out, the timing worked out just so that I found out I got accepted to the Naval Academy right before I graduated high school. And so I never wound up enlisting and went straight to college. So it all worked out.
So it was military was the plan either way.
Sure was. Yeah, and I was going to get there however I could get there.
So was your family, did they have a military history or?
They did, but they weren't exactly what I would call careerists. My dad was drafted into the Army in Vietnam, so he spent a couple of years over there. My grandfather on my mother's side was in the Navy. My grandfather on my father's side was in the Army. And, of course, he met my grandmother during World War II, and so she was a war bride. And,
oh, wow.
And I'm sure their parents before them, I don't know the history altogether that far back, but a little bit of a history there, yeah.
Now, the logistics, sometimes I'm sure we could get more and more into the weeds than we'd like, but I know I had some friends in high school that went into the various military academies. It's quite the process.
Yeah, it sure is. And so going to college, like any academic institution, there's academic requirements and there's application requirements and so forth.
Right.
But with the Naval Academy and the other service academies, you really get a double whammy because they're also a government institution. So there's lots of bureaucratic requirements too. So in high school, the kind of the keys here are having good grades, being academically savvy. At the time, there were SAT exams. I think they also take ACT exams now. You have to be physically fit. You have to be active. You have to be involved in sports. You have to demonstrate leadership, if not in fact, at least in capacity. And then on top of that, in order to even be considered to go there, you have to have an appointment from either a U.S. senator or a U.S. Congressman. So the long and short of it is senators get two appointments, and those two people typically are accepted by the admissions board. Congressmen have 10 essentially slots, if you will, where they present those to the admissions board of the Naval Academy and other service academies. And then the admissions boards from the service academies collect all of those and they pick from amongst that pool. So with 435 U.S. representatives times 10 candidates, that's 4,350 people that the admissions board has to weed out. So in my case, I was lucky. Senator Moynihan from New York, where I grew up, I was a runner-up for his appointment, and I also had a nomination from Congressman Maurice Hinchy, who was our representative at the time. So it all worked out in the end.
How do you go about getting these appointments? I mean, are you just writing letters? How do you do that?
At the time, it was writing letters, or in my case, I went to their local offices. They had an office not too far from where I lived. Nowadays, I imagine you can just apply online.
Uh-huh. got, which that's not as fun though.
Yeah, but everybody wants to apply online. I'm surprised you can't apply via text message.
Yeah, going into the office, that's, you know, old school cold call right there. So that's great. So you got your bachelor's in electrical engineering, if I'm not mistaken. Are all degrees from the military academies in like a STEM-related field?
They're not in STEM-related fields. The academies all have a very wide academic range of offerings. So, you know, using the Naval Academy as an example, you can graduate with a degree in engineering. You can graduate with a degree in mathematics or science, but you can also graduate with a degree in history, for example, or English. The service academies require you to take enough science, engineering, and technical courses that at the end of the day, regardless of what discipline your degree is, you still earn a Bachelor of Science degree. So you wouldn't get that Bachelor of Arts degree in English. You get a Bachelor of Science degree in English. So you definitely get that STEM background.
So you come to the end of your tenure there, and what was the transition process like? I mean, are you going into all right, here's your job now, or here's your location designation now? What was that like?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. During your senior year, you essentially put in kind of, I'll call it a wish list of the career field that you want to go to. And so in the Navy and Marine Corps, the Marine Corps is a tiny little part of the Navy as well. We all fall under the Department of the Navy. You can specify, I want to be a Navy pilot. I want to be a Navy submariner. I want to be a surface warfare officer. I want to be a Marine Corps officer. I want to be a Marine Corps pilot. And you then have to further qualify, you have to meet the requirements for each of those particular fields. And then yet another board meets to screen you for those fields. And then you find out towards the end of that, or towards the middle of that senior year, what specialty you actually were selected for. So sure. If you want something, you have to pursue it pretty assiduously.
Right. And you do have a commitment minimum.
Yeah, correct? Absolutely. Everybody has a minimum commitment for your time at the Naval Academy.
And what is that?
It's 5 years.
5 years.
So they give you a 4-year education. You're in it for five.
Five post education.
That's correct.
And just for the listeners out there, so if you get accepted and you go through the processes and everything's hunky dory, the tuition, room and board, all that is paid for. Is that right?
Entirely covered by Uncle Sam, yes.
Gotcha. He's a nice guy, isn't he?
No, he gets it back out of you, believe me.
Later on, huh? That's kind of what – he's coming back to your house asking for it now, huh?
He's at my door right now, as a matter of fact.
Oh, good. Hopefully he helps you shovel. So specifically, what was that process like for you, and where did you end up going from graduation?
Well, I applied as a Navy pilot. Got picked up, and so, you know, all those years later, I guess probably 8, 9, 10, 11 years later, I got picked up to become a Navy pilot. And so from there you graduate, and that's usually sometime in mid to late May, and then you move on to training in whatever that particular warfare specialty happened to be. So for Navy pilots, you take off and head down to Pensacola, Florida, which is otherwise known as the cradle of naval aviation, because that's where pretty much every Navy pilot gets a start. Navy Marine Corps pilot.
Is it? Huh?
Oh, yeah.
I had family that went to Pensacola Christian down there.
Oh, no kidding. It's a good little city down there.
And then how long did that last?
So you don't stay there the entire time. Essentially, there's a further weeding out process now, depending on what platform you're going to fly. So whether you're going to fly jets or propellers or helicopters or whatever the case might be. So in my case, I selected to fly P-3 Orions, which are sadly no longer around. So I may be dating myself a little bit, maybe feeling a little nostalgic here. But school for me involved some time in Pensacola. And then after Pensacola, we moved a little north for primary flight training and intermediate flight training. And then after that, advanced flight training down at NAS Corpus Christi, down in Corpus Christi, Texas.
Oh, okay.
But then you're still not done, because at the end of that training, you are simply qualified as a naval aviator. So the next step is a very basic qualification in whatever aircraft you're getting ready to fly. And so after Corpus Christi, Texas, was a move over to Jacksonville, Florida, to then fly the P-3 Orion for the first time.
Oh, okay. So that was your first official kind of stopping point.
Kind of, but not yet, because it gets better. Because after that initial exposure to your fleet aircraft, then you go to your first squadron, and your first squadron really is where the hard work begins, because you start training to qualify as a commander in whatever aircraft type. So that takes about another year to year and a half in that squadron.
Wow. So how many years are we looking at combined?
Probably about 3 years.
Wow. In addition to school. Yep. And then you get your first kind of post after that?
Yep. Well, so after you go to your first squadron, so post Jacksonville, we went to NAS Brunswick, Maine, and that's a 3-year tour. And so you spend 3 years, you know, like I said, getting qualified in your aircraft there. And that is your first real fleet tour where they actually send you out and you're actually deployed in your squadron. So at that point, we made a couple of deployments over to the Mediterranean through Sicily, Spain, Iceland, Greece. And then the second deployment after that was more of the same.
You know, you've been around the world, you've served in different roles, different places. Why do you think it's so important for people to get out of their bubble and experience the variety that the world has to offer?
Man, that's a great question. You know, I have friends. So I grew up in a small town in New York, and I still have friends that live over there that absolutely don't want to leave, that don't want to leave New York State. They're very happy where they are. And that's good. You know, I would never criticize somebody for the personal choices. And certainly there's something to be said for, building that stability, the opportunity to be really a deeply rooted member of that community that you live in. But on the other hand, you know, pursuing a career, whether it's, you know, whether you're in the military, whether you're in the Marine Corps, whether you're in the Peace Corps, that really gives you an opportunity to kind of, like you said, break out of that bubble, get out of that comfort zone that you grew up in, and branch out and learn. And there's a lot of people out there to learn from. There's a lot of different cultures. There's a lot of different places to go, things to see. And I don't think you really get to experience all of that if you want to just stay in one place for your whole life. But like I said, you know, it's not for everybody.
Mm-hmm. No, it is interesting. Even when we go on, you know, regional road trips, I'm like, wow, you know, you just get so caught up in your own little world. Sometimes you just forget, and you think that all the worries of your, your specific job in whatever city you live in is that's it.
And it's, I mean, like, even the next state over. Yeah. Think about it. Everybody has a different culture. It's wild. Even just in tiny New England here, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I met a guy from Vermont the other day, and he's like from a town on the border, but I'm from Vermont. I don't want people to mistake that I'm from New Hampshire. I was like, wow. I was like, I don't know. How am I supposed to take that? But yeah, people are there's, you know, subcultures and a lot of pride in people taking where they come from. But it's neat. It, like you said, it is neat to see the different variety and what we can learn from people. And did you have a favorite place in the world that you either were stationed at or visited or?
Well, without a doubt, our last duty station was Hawaii, and it's pretty hard to complain about being quote unquote forced to live out in paradise. But no, you know, the interesting thing is we here in America, and even in New England and the Northeast, you know, our history goes back. It goes back 200, you know, plus years, almost 300 years now. You don't really have a good perspective for history until you go to someplace like Italy, and their history is measured in millennia, not centuries, you know, and you're looking at thousands of years of history in front of you. And there is kind of an eye opener where you just think, wow, that's pretty crazy. There's other cultures that have been around way, way, way longer than ours. And it really gives you an appreciation, not just for history in general, but for just how far we've come as Americans in a couple hundred years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I've never thought of that. So I got to ask, what was it like working at the Pentagon?
Well, it's kind of a loaded question because it's really designed. It's painful is the bottom line. No, the Pentagon's a fascinating place to work. We spent probably a total of 6 years of my career there. And it's the first time that you go there, you stand at the steps and you kind of take it in and you look around and you're like, you think to yourself, holy cow, this is the Pentagon. All this awesome stuff happens here. And, you know, I can't wait to be a part of it all. And then by about the third week, that goes away because you're getting drugged through the ringer. In all seriousness, it's incredibly cool to be there because it's a, number one, it's a building. It's the world's largest low-rise office building. Just 25,000 people come to work there every day.
Oh, I didn't know that. Interesting.
The scale of it is immense, and about three quarters of those are active duty military, and the rest are civilians. And so maybe I have those reversed, but either way, that's a lot of people to be working in one building. And so amongst all of the services, the service secretariats between the, you know, the civilian oversight of the military, that really is the hub of all activity in the U.S. military. And so it's a really great perspective. It was for me as a young guy. I went there for my second tour. So I was probably, 25, 26 years old when we showed up there. And for somebody that young to get that kind of a view of operations around the globe, just that global perspective is really fascinating. So after I left there, you know, went and did a couple other tours, found myself back there again later on, a little bit older and maybe a little wiser, but probably not so much wiser. And so I kind of knew what to expect. But at that point, everybody looks at you and you're kind of like a Pentagon veteran almost. A kind of a,
yeah.
They say you get the Pentagon stink on you. Because it really is its own animal. And once you learn to work inside that bureaucracy, you become very valuable to the military because it's a steep learning curve if you haven't been there before. And so you get that Pentagon stink on you. And so, you know, automatically you show up there and you're getting down to work. So I had some pretty cool jobs there. My first job was working on the Quadrennial Defense Review, which is every 4 years that the DOD does a long-term study to make sure that, you know, the threats that we think we're going to face are aligned with the force that we're building long-term. That got caught up in a little bit of bureaucracy. So I wound up doing kind of a side gig, doing a study, a little depressing study on suicide in the Navy and how mental health issues kind of affect our force. And so that was difficult, but that was an eye opener. And then after that, I wound up working for the Chief of Naval Operations, who's the senior most officer in the Navy, as his special assistant. So I got to do things it was incredibly rewarding tour because I would do things like, you know, write congressional testimony for him, work on his public facing documents, his public image, those sorts of things. And really in the military, you know, we watch TV, anybody watches TV and you see stuff going on, you'll turn on TV and you'll see people testifying in front of Congress. And really that was one of those jobs for me where the feedback was very tangible and direct. I mean, something I wrote like the night before is now in the boss's hands. Now he's talking to the House Armed Services Committee about it. And so that was just really, really a cool perspective.
Wow. Yeah. It's like immediate impact.
Definitely. But I'll tell you, the other thing that you learn too is when you operate at that kind of level, the enormous, and I can't overstate this, enormous burden that our senior leaders are placed under. And it's just, that is their lives 24/7 is their job, because their job is not only global in scope for their particular service, but they're also a member of the service chiefs and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And they basically report directly to the president for all intents and purposes.
Wow. Yep.
So it's a pretty weighty thing that they have on their shoulders.
How do you think someone in that role or even in the role you were in, I mean, copes with that in even a health perspective? You know, are these guys and gals making sure they're setting aside time to exercise and eat healthy? I mean, I can't imagine. You know, I work a normal job now and I feel like sometimes I don't have time to do simple things like that.
It's absolutely amazing to watch. And these people function at such a high level. It's really extraordinary, but it really comes down to one thing and one thing only, and that's time management. And you'll see, and whether it's a CEO or whether it's a four-star admiral, they very, very, very highly value their time and very tightly manage their time. And so, you know, for example, I had one boss. I very first started working for him. He showed up, and his first kind of not motivational speech, but his very first discussion with us was, "Here's the deal: you're not going to work harder than me. You're not going to get here before me. You're not going to stay here after me. So don't even bother trying." And The guy would literally, he literally showed up for work at 5:30 in the morning. Every minute of his day was filled, and he went home probably 9 or 10 o'clock. And he did that every night, every day of the week, 6 days a week. And on the seventh day, he only worked 5 hours, say.
Oh, my goodness.
But throughout the day, if you look at his calendar, everything was regimented. Everything was to the point where things that you and I take for granted. Hey, it's about 10:30, 11 o'clock. Let's go get lunch. No, you don't take lunch until 11:25, you know, and 11:55, and your lunch is with somebody and you're doing business while you're eating lunch, you know, that sort of thing. And then the other thing they program in is physical fitness time, because at the end of the day, that's one of the ways that our bodies cope with stress is by being physically fit, you know, and it's a demanding job, and we basically try to stay ready for it. And so those guys, that's what they do.
Do you think a big part of managing your time well, whether it's that high level or someone in any role, is saying no?
Yeah, I think you have to learn to say no. But I also, you know, think that a big part of it is being able to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff and get to the point. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you have an opportunity to talk with, you know, say a senior leader, a congressman or senator or admiral or general or CEO or COO or whatever the case might be, you might feel like as you're talking to them that they're just being very blunt and they don't want to have fun and, you know, they don't like you, but that's not it. The point is that they need to very, 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 very carefully manage their time because that's their most valuable resource. So yeah, I think it's both. I think learning to say no is part of it, but realizing that managing time and using your time as a resource and protecting that resource is also very valuable.
Right. So you don't always have to say no. You just have to be efficient with the yeses you do accept.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great advice. I think managing time it's like a continual grind. I mean, some days I'll come home and I'm like, what did I do today? You know, but you got to give yourself a little grace to learn that and to grow and, you know, be better the next day. Cause it's like, if you get stuck in a rut, then you're just compounding everything. So,
yeah. And sometimes you get home and you feel like you just played a giant game of whack-a-mole. And like you said, you don't even know what you did, you know,
especially in your, you know, like an operations role and affected by weather and, you know, traffic and everything. I'm sure you have days you feel like that. So you went to get your master's at the Naval War College, you know, after many years in the military. Why did you decide to do that?
So for us, number one, first and foremost, it's an opportunity to better yourself and to further your education. And right about that midpoint of your career, the Navy's has in the past not been so great, but we've gotten much better about getting officers who are trying to further their career and become, you know, move along in their career to further that education. And so that period of in-residence scholarship is really just that. It's an opportunity to sit back, I won't say take a break because it's not a break, you're working, but to sit back and really be reflective on the things that you've learned heretofore in your career, number one, and number two, take the opportunity to think, study, and write. And those are some pretty important things because, you know, to be truly wise, you can't learn from your own experience. It's very limited. You're 20, 30, 40 years on the planet. There's only so much that you could have done, you know? And so really the idea here is to get you to learn from the experience of others through a very regimented period of study. And so it's the former SecDef, Jim Mattis. I don't know where the Mad Dog thing came from, but he just wrote a book. If you haven't read it yet, it's called Call Sign Chaos, Learning to Lead. It's a great book about how he developed as a leader, kind of the discussion that you and I are having. And in his book, he said, if you haven't read hundreds of books, quote, if you haven't read hundreds of books, you're functionally illiterate and you will be incompetent because your personal experiences alone aren't broad enough to sustain you.
Huh.
Just think about that, you know, and it's true because what can you, you can't possibly know everything that's gone on in the world, but there's chances are a book that can tell you about it, you know?
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Cause you get that as a reason for so many decisions from people is, you know, well, in my experience this or in my experience that. And you're right, we're missing the boat. There's a whole big world out there.
Yeah, you got to start early. And, you know, honestly, between him and the other senior leaders that I've worked with, they do. They read. One boss that I had that I was telling you about before, the guy, you know, the guy that said, don't bother coming in before me. That guy, when he worked out, he would use his time working out to read books. And so you'd see him on the treadmill or you'd see him on a stationary bike reading a book, and he read voraciously. His library probably was, you know, numbered in the thousands of books.
Wow. What do you typically read? Or are you in the middle of something right now?
Yeah, I finished Call Sign Chaos. That was a pretty good book by Secretary Mattis. I got done reading another book by Admiral Jim Stavridis, who just came out. It's called Sailing True North. It's basically character studies of, I think, 10 or 12 admirals throughout Navy history and their character flaws and character traits. And you know, all of these books are military, but they're a very human element because, again, like I was talking about earlier, leadership is a very human thing. There are certain things that are common to all humans, and so there's something that we can learn from everybody. I read a book called The Madness of Crowds, which is a pretty fascinating study in kind of like social groupings. A guy by the name of Doug Murray. And typically, though, I enjoy reading history, and in particular, military history. I'm in the middle of a book right now by Rick Atkinson called The British Are Coming, and he's essentially writing a trilogy about the American Revolution. So this is the first third of that trilogy. As a side note, he wrote another trilogy called The Liberation Trilogy about World War II in Europe, which is just absolutely phenomenal read. And then also I got my nose in a book about Winston Churchill. It's a 900.
That was on your desk when I first met you. I remember we talked about it a bit.
I had to take a break from reading that. It just got too weighty. And so that's when I went to those other three books.
I love history as well. Do you think it's important for people to recognize that history is messy and you can still glean lessons from people and events, even if they weren't perfect?
Oh, I think that's a requirement. I think if you read history with really any other frame of mind, I think that I'm not going to say you're wrong. I'm not trying to judge people here, but I think that, you know, history is filled with good examples, but probably also filled with bad examples.
Right.
And really, when you learn from history, you want to learn from those bad examples, you know?
Right.
Don't do this.
So how do you, as a leader, how have you led? What is your leadership style?
Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question there. I think any leader, I'm not trying to hold myself up here as any kind of a good leader, for example, but just my personal style has always been really getting into the nitty-gritty and into the weeds. And I don't mean that in the sense of micromanagement. I mean that in the sense of finding the people that do the work and then doing the work alongside those people, whether it's you know, in the military, I spent a lot of time in a squadron, for example, with the people that fix the airplanes. Because number one, you want to know those guys. You want to know they're doing a good job because you're the guy that's flying it.
Yeah.
You know, and number two, it's genuinely interesting. You genuinely are able to build a rapport with those people when they see that you actually care about who they are, what they're doing, why they're doing it. You know, and not just in the sense that, hey, tell me why you're turning that wrench, but, you know, tell me about your family. Tell me about, you know, any number of things, what's going on in your life. And oh, by the way, that also helps you to really pinpoint problems before they really become problems. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, people will be more apt to come and talk to you and reveal themselves and say, hey, I have this going on, if they know you and they're comfortable with you and they think they can trust you. And building that rapport, I think, is absolutely essential.
Right. And then you get that credibility with that group.
That absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I love about Dead River Company is, you know, we are very highly encouraged, not directed because our bosses don't micromanage us, but very highly encouraged to get and stay close to the work. In other words, get out next to those guys that are actually, you know, in people's basements fixing boilers and furnaces and things like that. Get out onto delivery trucks and do those things. So I do that every week. I carve out one day out of my schedule, and the cell phone goes away. It doesn't get turned off just by necessity, but I'm either on a delivery truck out pulling hoses and making deliveries to our customers, or I'm on a service van going into customers' basements and working on boilers and cleaning things out and all those sorts of things that our service techs do. So, and I think that's, you know, it helps us stay grounded as well, because we're in leadership positions to make good decisions, and we're paid to make good decisions based on our knowledge and our capacity and our ability to make those. But I don't think you can make a good decision if you don't know how that decision is going to affect the people that work for you.
Right, right. You got to know the foundation of the process prior.
Absolutely.
Well, good for you. That's neat. I've had bosses, you know, that used to get out and, you know, wash trucks if they needed to, things like that. And, you know, it just, you do gain a level of respect, obviously, but it's, I mean, that's hard work what you guys do, you know, especially in, you know, freezing temperatures and going out at night. The work they do isn't always a pre-scheduled thing. You know, I'm sure you guys have emergencies and things like that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you kind of alluded to earlier, it's weather dependent. So for example, last Thursday I was on a delivery truck in the northern part of the state, just outside of Thornton, and the temperature was 1 degree.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, so it's brutal physically, but sometimes it's also brutal emotionally. You know, we had one customer call, a person who was all out of, or almost all out of heating oil that we had to deliver to. And, oh, by the way, you know, they needed the heating oil to heat a house because their father had just been sent home in hospice care because he was dying of cancer. So, wow. So there's also an emotional aspect to it as well. And our drivers and our technicians, they're out there in that environment every day, and people look at you and they look to you for solutions.
Right. Right. Yeah. It definitely puts a sense of urgency on it.
Sure does.
What has helped you in your career earn promotions and continue to grow?
You know, as I think about that, Chris, I think it's sort of two separate questions, and part of which being the promotion side. And I'll talk about that first. As far as the military and the Navy is concerned, it is certainly bureaucratic, but I have to say that the promotion and selection process for promotions is enormously fair, and the entire sole criteria for promotion within the Navy is best and most fully qualified. And so that is to say, you know, is this guy qualified to do the job, and is he the best person to do the job? And so, you know, to that extent, there's a level of proficiency involved, and there's a level of ability involved, and there is having that record to back it up. And so, like any job, you have periodic evaluations, and as long as you do well in those evaluations and demonstrate that sustained superior performance, you'll be moved along. And so, you know, to that extent, I think performance is one part of it. Growth really has to be something that you're personally dedicated to. And I think it's establishing a routine and doing all of those things. And I'm not trying to answer a question with a question here or have some sort of recursive definition, but doing all those things that, you know, make you grow, in the sense that you have to focus on those things that bring you, to that next level. So number one, first and foremost, is reading and learning, you know, and it's not just books, but reading about your job and growing in that profession. And then really, when you go to work every day, prioritizing your day and making sure that at the end of the day, you've learned something, and that's growth. And so, you know, for me, that really staying on that learning curve is really important.
Now, are you still involved with the military at all?
I'm not actively, obviously I'm not in the military anymore. I'm of course retired, but I still definitely keep in touch with a lot of people that I served with along the way, and try to do the best that I can to mentor them and give them guidance as far as particular situations. And it's a little easier for them to talk to somebody who's sort of separated, I guess, from the day-to-day trials and tribulations of military life.
Someone to lean on, right. So describe the transition process from military to, you know, quote, civilian life. And this is all fairly recent for you. How did that work, and how did you pre-plan and then do the process after that?
Yeah. How long do you have to talk about it? Transition is one of those things from military to civilian life where it's made out to be this really huge deal because you're taking off uniform, you're leaving one kind of, I guess, closing one chapter of your life and starting another chapter of your life. But I'll say that in the military, one of the kind of prime facets of military life is making a transition every 2 to 3 years. I mean, I described to you earlier, just going through flight school alone was like four full moves across the Southeast U.S., eventually ending up in Brunswick, Maine. So you're always moving. You're always moving every 2 to 3 years, going from one job to another. And so really you're taught on a very small scale how to balance transitions. And I don't mean small in the sense that it's definitely a major transition for your family and your life and your career and so forth. But, you know that you have the military to rely on, you're going to another military job, you have people that are helping you out, all that other stuff. Going from military to civilian life is a little bit different. It's a little bit more significant in that at the end of your career, you know, we do a really good job in the military of saying, hey, this is your next step, go here. Then this is your next step, go here, then do this. And then you're going to go here. But at the end of your career, there's nobody to say, hey, Jason, go here.
Right.
So the biggest questions, the whole Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like you really have to figure out, for yourself. You're kind of left to your own. And the military does an okay job. I mean, they give you a week and they give you a class, a transition readiness class. Mm-hmm. They let you go through once or twice, or in some cases, three times if you need to go through it, that tries to give you those skills like resume writing and interviewing and where to find jobs and how to prep and those sorts of things. And those are all well and good, but it's only part of the story. So the thing that they also preach is to start early. And so you really have to be thinking ahead of time, like not just a few months ahead of time, but like a couple of years ahead of time and really plan all of that out.
Were you able to do that?
Well, I thought I did. I started about a year and a half out going through those sorts of planning processes. And so when I was, I think probably about 6 months from final retirement, maybe a little bit more, I actually got offered a job with a company up in Portland, Maine. And I was at home with, I don't know, a couple weeks left of vacation prior to finally separating and retiring officially from the military. And the company called me up and said, hey, sorry, we just fired our CEO and everybody that he hired, we're telling not to come to work here. So sorry about that.
Wow.
So even if you start a year and a half or two or five or 10 years ahead of time, right at the last second, things can change. And again, that gets to what I was talking about a minute ago in terms of balancing and managing change and managing transitions. So kind of went back to the drawing board. And as you alluded to earlier with as far as the Boots to Roots video is concerned, I found them. They were a great organization who really helped me with finding the jobs that were available. And part of my problem was we lived in Hawaii, like I told you earlier. We wanted to move back to New England. And so we didn't really have any sort of professional network here to speak of. And that's kind of where Boots to Roots stepped in and filled that role well for us. So really starting early, but being aware that even if you do start early, you're going to run into road bumps along the way, and you just have to be ready with a plan B and a plan C.
Yeah. And it's hard to get a lay of the land. You're right, when you don't live there. So I can imagine.
Totally.
It takes time. So you're originally from New York, correct?
Yep.
So what, do you just love the Northeast, or why Hawaii coming back to the Northern New England?
Yeah, good question. So we decided, my wife and I were married back in 99. So we celebrated our 20th anniversary a couple of months ago.
Oh, congrats.
And thank you. And when we left our first duty station in New Brunswick, Maine, we left Maine in the rearview mirror and decided that, New England was where we wanted to come back to and finally settle down after I was done in the military. And so, you know, many years later, that's a promise that we kept to each other. That was one part of it. And then the other part of it, of course, is we both have family around here. And so our families aren't getting any older or any younger, rather. And so it's nice to be able to be a little bit closer to them and not separated by, 5,000 plus miles and either 5 or 6 hours, depending on whether it's daylight savings time or not.
Right. No, absolutely. So it was kind of decided on a long time ago then. That's
cool.
Yeah,
sure was.
Family drives a lot of it, I'm sure. I mean, that's why we moved here from Colorado. So no, I get it. Hawaii sounded all right, but
it was amazing. Tell you what,
you're an accomplished guy. You've had a lot of neat experiences, and this I'm putting you on the spot here, but you, when I first met you and just since we've talked, you're a very humble guy. And how do you stay in that state, and how do you constantly respect people and not take a, almost an overbearing view of you know, what you've done and your accomplishments.
You know, honestly, Chris, it gets to what we were talking about before, and that is getting out of the bubble that we grew up in. And I think the more that you get out and the more you work with people, the more you experience, the more you realize that everybody has, for lack of a better term, I don't mean it to sound this way, but everybody has an angle. Everybody has something that they're concerned with. Everybody has something that's really important to them. And just being able to realize that, you know, you're not always number one. Your priorities aren't always number one. Sometimes you have to be able to tune into what other people are saying, and then develop a communication skill to actually, you know, to talk with them rather than talk past them, which I think we do in a lot of ways these days. I
mean, yeah,
you can turn on a cable news channel probably right now and see five people talking past each other and nobody's listening to each other. Well, you know, so much of work and human interaction is just realizing that people speak and think and act differently, and then having that kind of awareness to compensate for yourself. And, you know, I'm not, John Gray wrote a book called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. You probably heard it before. And it really is talking about, you know, relationships between men and women and marriages and so forth. But I think a lot of those techniques really apply to interacting with people in general. And that is to say, I'm talking to you, but what I think I'm saying to you, you might not actually be hearing, and being smart enough to understand that, you know, and really get to that state where you're able to communicate with people. And I think that's important. The second thing I think that's important is, you know, it sounds cliche, but it's really not. And that is, you have to treat everybody with dignity and respect, because that really, just kind of standard golden rule stuff. And again, we've gotten way far out of the box in a lot of ways, lately with that, but you know, everybody wants to be respected. Everybody wants to be valued. Everybody wants to feel like they're part of a team. And there's something to be said for making them and doing your best to be inclusive and create that environment for them.
No, that's great. And like I said, I have a lot of respect for you. And you know, I always wanted to work for humble people, you know, just because it's more fulfilling, it's a more inviting environment. So I think that's all great leadership advice. When it comes to your career, would you go back and change anything?
I think if anything, I discovered later in life an incredible amount of joy that I derived from reading. Mm-hmm. And so if now old Jason could go back and talk to young Jason, I would highly recommend picking up a good book.
Yeah, just earlier on and more frequently.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you were speaking to young people or someone that needed inspiration in their career, what parting piece of career advice would you give to them? Maybe they're listening today, and like I said, maybe they're starting out, finding out what's out there. Maybe they are, you know, down and looking for change.
You know, circling back to the whole guidance counselor thing, you know, I'm probably not alone in saying I've seen guidance counselors steer people in a lot of directions that maybe they shouldn't have gone, or maybe weren't the best directions for them, and not casting aspersions on them. But I think I would just recommend that if you're looking for change, just talk to people. And really, that's the best way to learn about stuff, is find somebody that in an industry that you think you're interested in, or find somebody that's doing that you think you would want to do, and just have a conversation with them. Look them up on LinkedIn and either, you know, connect with them or just send them a message out of the blue and say, introduce yourself and say what you're interested in and kind of strike up that conversation. Most people would be more than happy to take a couple of minutes and say, hey, this is the goods and bads and others of my industry. This is some things to think about. This is some things that, you know, maybe some things you don't want to do, or maybe, you know, maybe stay away from this industry entirely, or stay away from this particular company entirely, or whatever the case might be. But I think the more that you explore, the more you talk to other people, the better off you are. And as far as, you know, career development is concerned, the biggest piece of advice I would give people is to read as much as humanly possible, not just about what they're interested in, but what they're not interested in, because you never know what you're going to find in a good book.
That's a great point. And I think part of the problem, kind of like you said, is exposure. I mean, people just don't know what's out there. When I moved from Colorado to New Hampshire, it was like I had worked for the same company since college, which granted was only 5 years and it wasn't an eternal amount of time. But when I started looking again, I was like, I just have to get a lay of the land and even see what options are out there. That was like step one. Well, awesome. Hey, I super appreciate you coming on. And, you know, it's fun we connected again. And I did want to say, you know, we're very grateful for your service and our military and all the years you spent alongside other men and women defending our country. So definitely super grateful for that. I don't know what it's like. I have no experience, but I know it's important. So
thanks so much, Chris. And thanks for recognizing that as well. It's you know, it means a lot to those of us who have served or are serving in uniform for sure.
Hey everyone, and thanks for listening to the show today. I wanted to thank Jason for being on. I also want to thank all the men and women in uniform that have served or are serving. We are very grateful for the sacrifices that you make to keep our country safe. Don't forget to check us out on careeryak.com or follow us on social media at careeryak. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. Hey everyone, one way you can support the show is by checking out our new affiliate partner, Lone Birch Company, based out of New Hampshire, where I am as well. Their owner and founder, Jarek, actually did an interview with me. His episode may or may not be out, depending on when you're listening to this, but go check them out and use the coupon code CAREER for 10% off. They make wood, handmade wood products for your desk or office setting. So check them out. Super high quality stuff, and it'll help Jarek's business and the show. Thanks.